Don't sweat the small stuff. Forgive yourself. Put people first. Life advice comes at us from all directions. Some stuff rises to the top, and we're talking about the more helpful morsels here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're on a search for how to live a happy life, and we're asking for life advice, gathering your questions that keep you up at night. We're at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about relationships? Do the people you love often think you don't care much about them and you wish you knew how to prioritize making them feel loved? Do you have no idea how to make the people you feel loved? Elizabeth Bernstein is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She writes a column called Bonds, which is all about relationships. Elizabeth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
You receive thousands of letters, lots of mail from people every year asking about all things in life. What are some of the most common themes? What rises to the top?
You know, the main theme really is connectivity. How can people connect better with, as you say, with the people you love? And how can I talk to them better? How can I express my love? Lots of the letters are frustrated. Something happened. What do I do? And then there's some other themes. People want to know how to tell someone. A very big one is how to tell someone they love them if they haven't, how to repair a relationship, how to talk about the end of life, how to talk about death before it's too late. Tell somebody you love them then. Get a lot of letters about sex because that is an ongoing fascination among
sure.
people. Letters about how do I apologize, loneliness. It really, and a whole lot, another sort of big area is, you know, how to be happy, but also people who are depressed. Hey, I'm really struggling. What do I do?
Well, let's look at one of these areas, starting out with being alone. You also address, you know, people wondering if they'll be okay alone. Why do you think loneliness is something people worry a lot about?
It gives people anxiety. We're social creatures. I mean, if you go way, way back in our evolutionary period, we're sort of created like to live in packs. And when you're outside that pack, you're a little more vulnerable, or a lot more vulnerable if you think about a time when a mastodon might come and, like, pick you off. So you're vulnerable outside of that pack. It's really built deep into our DNA. And so we connect, and also just now it's helpful, right? It's much easier to pay a mortgage with, you know, two incomes. It's, you know, easier to get a lot done parenting. You know, we need other people. That's really built into our fabric.
You write in one of your pieces that many lonely people wish they had social plans or a bigger network of friends to call upon, but sometimes even when they do, they avoid contact, and this can lead to a downward spiral of more loneliness. So what can people do to overcome this tendency?
You really have to push yourself. So, you know, people who have fewer social ties, maybe you've moved and it's a temporary thing, or you've gotten divorced, or there's been a death of, you know, a spouse and your circumstances have changed. But some people by nature are more loners, really, or they have some social anxiety. And also when you're depressed, when you're down, you don't have the energy to keep up the social ties. And there's something sort of in that depressive process that tells you to isolate, which is very harmful. So what can people do? They really have to push through whatever it is, the shyness, the fear that someone's going to reject them if they reach out. If you just remind yourself, like, hey, most people are scared of being lonely. We all worry about it and deal with it at different times. No one's going to fault you. There's no stigma on being lonely, or there shouldn't be. You shouldn't feel shamed.
We're talking with Elizabeth Bernstein. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she writes a column there called Bonds, which is about relationships. Gathering your questions, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. You can send your relationship questions, from the family ones to the friendship to the questions about yourself. You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Elizabeth, you also field questions from people about how to deal with those who just, you know, flat out irritate you, many people who are perhaps family members. Why do you think the people who we're supposed to love most also tend to get on our nerves the most?
because they were around them the most. That's one piece of it. But also, we can let our guard down. We try to be in our best behavior for strangers and people we don't know very well, or hopefully in the workplace. But the closer we get to people, the more we let them see the real us. And so then there's this danger that we're not even polite after a while. And certainly there's things in families like competition among siblings, even adult siblings, or wounds, old wounds maybe from childhood, emotional wounds. And so these things all add up to some pretty serious problems between people.
Oh, because things can just build and build both inside of you and another family member, perhaps.
Exactly. And there's resentment and hurt, and this was never really repaired. You never said you're sorry. And this could be something little, you forgot my birthday, or it could be something very, very big. You weren't there during my childhood. You're my parent. And so these things do foster and need to be dealt with.
Well, let's look at couples now. A lot of times couples disagree. There is a couple you wrote about, Joe and Carrie. Both of them believed their own version of events were more reliable when it came to an argument they had over whether Joe told Carrie he was buying an arcade machine from eBay. And Elizabeth, how can we handle these types of arguments, which can be, who's right here?
And that's just it. Probably both of them. Their memories, our memories are all different. Memories are very subjective. So, that was a good couple. So, suddenly, you think you okay the arcade machine as it's coming in the door to be set up in your basement, but there can be a big problem like that. So, we both have versions. We have to, address the issue maybe, earlier on and communicate better. And, certainly denial is a powerful thing. And if you wanted to, say, move an arcade machine, buy it and put it in the dining room, you might not be as clear as you should about that. You might talk around the issue, and that's where the problem becomes. So better communication is helpful. And then you really have to, when you argue, you have to do several things. You have to just focus on the matter at hand. You can't throw in, you're mad about that arcade machine in your kitchen. You cannot throw in everything, the kitchen sink, everything. You can't be mad about something 2 years ago. You just have to focus on the issue. And you have to speak compassionately. You have to really dial down the anger.
Yeah, but it's so hard for things to spiral if the other spouse, brings something else into the argument, and then you're kind of like one-upping. You're going to bring something in.
Oh, exactly. You're going to one-up them. I'm a big fan of deep breathing. I mean, I deep breathe, and I'm a big fan of doing it in the middle of a heated conversation, in the middle of a deadline, when the plane ride gets turbulent. Like, deep breathing can reset your circulation, your nervous system, actually. Like, it can, help you calm it down. And so if you can sort of take a few deep breaths, you can say, hey, you know what, I want to talk to you. You're important to me. This conversation's important. I don't want to escalate it. Let me take a walk. Let me, go to the other room for a few minutes. I'm going to come back calmer. You want to actively work on yourself to be calmer and sort of notice, if the other person's, throwing in an argument from 2 years ago and escalating it, you can still try to do the right thing and stop that escalation right there.
We're getting useful tips on how to do stuff better and be better at relationships. Elizabeth Bernstein is with us. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and her column is called Bonds. It's all about relationships. Do the people you love think you don't care enough about them and you wish you knew how to prioritize making them feel loved? Do you have no idea how to make the people you feel you love feel loved? What questions do you have for the relationship columnist? Bring them on at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Find your passion, be authentic, share your story. Recent words of advice from lifestyle icon Martha Stewart in a recent keynote speech she gave. We're getting life advice to put to use here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's some more advice along the lines of, to be good to yourself, do one nice thing for yourself and one nice thing for someone else each day. What's the best advice you've received in love and in life? Are you working through perhaps an end-of-life relationship? Do you have a loved one who's dying and you don't know how to talk with them? Your relationship questions, they matter. They're welcome at 800-642-1234. Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Bernstein stays with us, and she writes the Bonds column, which is about relationships. Let's go to the phones now with Marianne joining us from Superior. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning. One of the things that I have found, people always say, well, you're so friendly. I did not come out of the womb shaking hands. And friendliness for me begins with a hello, whether it's in my neighborhood, the apartment complex, or if you're shopping. Sometimes just looking at someone in the eyes and saying hello can begin a conversation. I see so much loneliness. And then if you can stop and listen, people have such wonderful stories if you can just take a little time and really listen to them.
Marianne, thank you so much for the call. Elizabeth, it sounds like Marianne is saying friendliness is something you work on. It is something you work on through life.
It really is, or if it doesn't come naturally to you, as Marianne says, it doesn't come to her. You can, and that's just what she just said is so beautiful. Can you imagine what a better place it would be if we all were just saying hello and being kind in line and hearing each other's stories? Because on a very sort of basic level inside us, that's what we all want, is to be seen and heard and just cared about. And strangers, our interactions with strangers through the day. Like, research shows they can really boost our mood a lot, because they can alleviate some of that loneliness, even just a few minutes at the store. But also, they aren't the people we're arguing with and we're annoyed with. So there's no baggage to that relationship, really. But, I mean, her sentiment is so wonderful.
Elizabeth, you write about how to talk to a loved one who is dying, and you start the column with an anecdote about a person whose partner is dying, and he tells her he's not going to be around much longer, and she responds by telling him not to talk that way. So do people often ask you about how to talk to their dying loved one?
They do. And this column that you're mentioning, I've written my column for almost 10 years on relationships. This column is the most popular one. It was the one that was the most read. And it's because I think this is such a sticky issue. We fear it more than anything. We're going to lose a loved one for good. And as that time is coming up, many times we know it's happening, right? This person, we're losing them. They're sick. Something's, you know, we're going to lose them. We tend to go down double down into denial. And it's very easy to do. It seems like a compassionate thing to do. I don't want to mention this. I don't want to hurt the person who's dying. I don't want to remind them. The dying person doesn't want to cause anxiety for the survivors. So we don't talk about it. And that's not kind to either person. It's very stressful and can be very hurtful. And it can leave you without this like sense of really connecting, you know, at a time that's so important and showing love.
So how would you recommend people talk to a partner, a friend, or a family member who is about to pass?
You know, so for this one, you have to really, again, you have to push through sort of your feeling that, you know, I shouldn't. And maybe the other person doesn't want to. Look, if the person who's, you have someone who's dying and they don't want to talk, don't push it. You're supposed to be kind to them right now, right? But, you know, you should test that. See if they do. Bring it up. Say, look, you can share your feelings. There's something I wanted to tell you. I'm really scared. I'm going to miss you. I loved you. Many times, the first time people are saying I love you to someone is at this end of life stage. So you can do it. You could write it down if you're nervous. Write it down and read it. Say, look, I want to read you this. I was too scared. I think I'll cry. Let me, you know, read it to you. So you can do that. And you can. There's different types of things people even talk about at that end of life. They can talk about, you know, the dead dying person can, you know, talk about what their hopes for you are, what they hope they'll have you do. That can be very powerful. Years ago, my grandfather, when he was dying many years ago, I was in college, said, you know, I hope you become a writer. I hope you, it'll be hard. I hope you stick with it, Elizabeth. And that really helped me. It still helps me. Like, I hear his voice, like, you know, on every deadline, don't drop the ball here. but, you know, so you can have these identity messages. You can, you know, talk about the afterlife if you're religious or spiritual. You know, you can have everyday talk. You could just spend time together and let that person keep living till the last moment. It's really important.
Many of the questions people submit to you are really about them wanting your validation. They want to hear that they're normal, that they're okay, or that they made the right move, the right decision. Why do you think people need this reinforcement?
We get in so far into our own heads, like this is where we live. So we get so far into our own heads, we're very worried, and then your problem tends to take on this larger life. Like everybody knows I'm lonely. How ashamed am I that I don't have any friends or anybody to turn to? It's not like that. Like people they're not shaming usually by nature. And also we sort of lose this context or this understanding that our problems are pretty universal. You know, and I see this across the board from people worried that they're depressed or lonely or they're having a problem in their marriage to people just worried. You know, I write about a lot of sex research. People are worried with that. Like, hey, I don't know if I'm doing it right. Well, you know, if you thought this up, you're probably doing what someone else thought up.
And, you know, just even the act of reaching out for advice, to have to write it down, to have to go through the motions of thinking through what this is that is keeping someone up at night, that is therapeutic in itself.
You know, it is. It's, you know, people, I'm always struck by the number of people who write me and say, I got one this week who say, you know, I'm up, it's 2 a.m. and I was Googling the answer to whatever their relationship problem is or whatever they're worried about. This is someone worried about her son in college who she thought was suicidal. So I'm very worried. What do I do? I found your article. Can you give me more advice? And what always strikes me is, wow, like how lonely, how desperate we are for sort of these answers on relationships and how to relate. If we're up Googling like a reporter, you know, in the middle of the night, I always feel a little worried, like, whoa, you found me. I better have the best advice. But there's a great deal of like we're alone in our problems out there. And, you know, maybe the answer is, you know, across the hall or, you know, even, you know, across the bed. Like talk to the people around you. Just keep connecting.
What is the favorite question you've ever received? Something that you just hold close, that you just absolutely love?
You know, I love the ones that sort of, I can answer. The ones where I have a good answer. Some of them are just cute, I think. Like, I love the woman who wrote me and said, hey, you know, wrote about, you know, long-term marriage and sex in long-term marriage and how couples keep a spark alive. I deeply love my husband. Can you tell me how I could become attracted to him? Yeah, I think that's a really always, like, a charming one. Or, you know, I like the ones where they're just trying to connect again. Or, you know, just can you, you know, one woman wrote once, I had a fight with my husband. It was about a sponge in the kitchen. Neither one, like, why isn't it clean in the sink? Why is it still hanging out on the stove? You know, so like these ones that are really sort of universal, right? Who hasn't thought about some version of the sponge in the sink? So even though that was a problem and deep enough to make this woman write a stranger, write a relationship columnist, but it's so universal. Like we all know what that feeling is and how we want to de-escalate the sponge fight.
So among the thousands of letters you get from readers each year, sometimes people send you their own advice, apparently. What's some of your favorite advice that people have sent to you?
You know, my all-time favorite was from a man in his 80s. He said, you know, I'm 82, and I've thought a lot about life, and I've seen a lot of changes. I've seen relationships. I've seen political changes. I'm going to give you, just out of the blue, Elizabeth, I'm going to give you the very best advice, and it's brilliant. He said, I have this
bucket, and he had a name for it. It rhymes with bucket, but he's had this bucket in my head, and I put everything there that I just don't want to deal with. And it could be a politician I don't like. It can be, you know, the stock market went down today. It can be my wife drove me nuts.
Things that are out of his control.
Things that are out of my control. Not my wife. But, you know, that I love her, and you want to see her. But you know, somebody annoyed me. Somebody cut me off in traffic. You know, somebody's on TV annoying. I'm going to put this in this sort of bucket in my head, this imaginary bucket, and I'm just going to let it go. It just sits there. I'm going to dump that bucket out. And it really is brilliant advice, like to put these things. There's nothing, if you're at, Thanksgiving dinner and, you know, your adult siblings snipes at you, like there's nothing you can do. Just put it in your head away, let it go, let it float away, and move on with your day and your meal and, you know, the love. And so I just hold that one really deep. He and I now are like occasional sort of email pen pals, and he's always got excellent advice. So, you know, and well-earned advice, I assume.
Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Bernstein is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She writes a column called Bonds, which is all about relationships. Coming up, Wisconsin has the lowest pay rate in the nation for public defenders. We'll look what's behind it here on the Ideas Network.